This is the Norris Group's Real Estate Investor Radio Show, the award-winning show dedicated to thought leaders shaping the real estate industry and local experts revealing their insider tips to succeed in an ever-changing real estate market. Hosted by author, investor, and hard money lender, Bruce Norris.
The Norris Group proudly presents our 14th annual award-winning event, I Survived Real Estate. Industry experts join Bruce and Aaron Norris to discuss evolving industry trends, real estate bubbles, inflation, and opportunities emerging for real estate professionals. All proceeds from the event benefit Make-A-Wish and St. Jude Children's Research Hospital.
Hi, thank you for joining us. My name is Bruce Norris, and today our special guest is Mike Cantu. I've known Mike for almost 30 years. Along with having a portfolio of well-located rentals, Mike has been a very successful flipper, land developer, and on occasion teacher and mentor to investors. From my point of view, his disciplined approach and the willingness to keep learning set him apart. So Mike, welcome back to our radio shows.
Thanks for having me, Bruce.
I'm always interested to know if as a kid, people were entrepreneurial. So did you have an entrepreneurial side of you that was early and you could say, yeah, that's not everybody's doing this. You were entrepreneurial from early age.
Yes, I was, Bruce, but it was out of necessity, not by choice. See, I never got an allowance as a kid, and I had friends that lived south of the school I went to that were much better off. They had allowances and nice stuff, and I was kind of wanted some of that. Asked my dad for an allowance, and he thought that was hilarious. And instead, I got a used lawnmower with an invoice for $40 for the parts and three addresses, and explained that that was my new allowance. So I started cutting grass. That was probably in about fourth grade, and somewhere around that same time, yes, I sold candy at school. I would take my 25-cent lunch money, go to 7-Eleven and buy packs of Starburst. And you got 12 pieces in a pack, and I sold them for a nickel a piece. So I converted lunch money, and then I was able to trade Starburst for the lunches anyways. So I got the best of both worlds. I got my lunch, and I got some money out of it.
Was there someone in your life that you watched be entrepreneurial, or there was a seed in you?
That these were all light bulbs going off, enlightenment. Hey, if I do this, maybe I can do that. And yeah, besides the candy selling, I orchestrated an aluminum can drive. I had a friend, I had the bike, I made a stick with a nail on the end of it, duct taped it together. I supplied the trash bags, but he climbed into the dumpster. I would ride him over to the apartments on the handlebars of my bike. So he did the dirty work. I supplied everything, had the idea, and he smashed them up. And then we turned them in, and it wasn't quite a 50-50 split. His mom came over after a whole summer and asked why he only made that much money, which was, I'm embarrassed to say, but it was about 10% of the haul. And I explained that I was the boss, he was the worker, and explained to her how business worked.
And you were in what grade?
Fourth grade. That was fourth grade. And then there was a huge apartment complex, probably a good 400 or 500 units. And then I got the idea that we were going to do a bottle drive. And it was only for returnable Coke bottles. And I came up with a pitch. It was something about the Colony Park Youth Basketball Association, fall season, new uniforms and equipment. Oh, I wanted a basketball. So that was legit. And we did the bottle drive, made lots of money, spent a lot of it on Slurpees and yo-yos and stuff like that that you bought in elementary school. Go ahead.
I'm just curious, did you recognize anyone else in your class with the same bent?
No. Nobody was doing that. That was, I thought I was onto something and really didn't care to share it with a lot of people. I thought I'm going to build this one for all it's worth.
That's just amazing. I mean, honestly, that's amazing. That was definitely not part of what I viewed. I didn't know anybody like that. And it took a long time for me to figure out that I could actually work for myself instead of someone else. But I don't think you ever you've worked for Mick Blackwell for a very short length of time.
And then we became partners.
Yes,
now,
right.
I did go through a series of jobs in about a 4-month period. There must have been 6 or 7 of them. And I realized I'm not cut out for any of that stuff. That was my 16, somewhere teenage years. I went through a strange period there. And I thought, nope, none of this is for me.
Where did the skateboard skill come in? And how did you end up getting on a national team?
I went surfing when I was in 7th grade. And I absolutely loved every second of it, but I lived an hour from the beach. And so when I got home, that was out. And I thought Nick's best thing is going to be skateboarding. So I put together a skateboard. My dad helped me make it. The first one came from a pair of roller rink skates that we dissected, and I became obsessed with it. There was a point where I think my feet were stuck to the grip tape of a skateboard on average about 8 hours a day.
Wow.
So it was transportation. It was entertainment. It was passion. I thought this side can go a long ways with this, but it was never intended to be a professional skateboarder. That's just where it ended up.
And how did it end up like that?
I was asked, I was at the Pipeline Skate Park, and Pepsi had put together a Pepsi skateboard team, and guy that I had met, Stacy Peralta, asked me if I wanted to be on the Pepsi skateboard team. I told him I was just started my junior year of high school, and he said, that's not going to work. So I looked into it, and I ended up taking the high school proficiency test and passed it, so I didn't have to go to school, and off I went to be a pro skateboarder.
So you got to graduate basically in your junior year?
No, I got a proficiency diploma that basically said I had passed the test covering everything that they teach you in high school.
Okay.
And at that point, Bruce, I thought I knew it all. In fact, I think I told somebody, I know everything there is to know now except 2 things, and they haven't been invented yet, so I'm not going to worry about it.
Okay.
That was a bit of arrogance. And then by the time I turned 18, Bruce, I thought the life had beaten me up good. I'd been out on my own for 2 years, and I realized I didn't know anything.
Now, your dad wanted you obviously to learn how to stand on your own 2 feet. And you and I've had many lunches together. One of my favorite ones is about your dad was when you didn't make your bed.
I grew up with military discipline. There were 7 kids and 2 adults in an 1,100 square foot house. You made your bed military style after you got out of it. If you ever left for school without a bed being made, you came home to no sheets and pillow and no need to ask about it because you're not getting it. You're sleeping on a mattress. And you do that a few times, and there's first thing you do, get out of bed and make your bed. To this day, Bruce, I make my bed. Not to honor my dad or anything, but for a sense of accomplishment. Get out of bed, did something. Okay, I can check that one off.
And you have a few of those things. I know you have an exercise routine that follows shortly thereafter of some type.
Yeah, it's about an hour after waking up. I have tried for years and years, Bruce, to get out of bed and start going, and oh no, I have to go through this metamorphosis from a waste of skin into a human being that takes some coffee, a newspaper, and just a little wandering around. So it takes me a while to pull it together.
That's funny.
But if it starts at 7, by 9 o'clock, though, I'm done with the whole metamorphosis. I start and I end up as a driven capitalist heading out the door.
When did you get to meet Mick Blackwell, and what was your first, contact with him? What did you do with him?
A friend of mine that I skateboarded with, he was a few years older than me. He was actually dating Mick's daughter, and he was a carpenter. And I went to work with Pablo to frame a house for Mick. That was my first exposure to Mick. And I put in an honest day's work, and he hit me up to work for him for the weekend. And that was when my first exposure to the real Mick. That's when he said, we only work half days around here. And I thought, I like this guy. And he said, it doesn't matter if it's first 12, the last 12, or the 12 right out of the middle, half days. And that was absolutely a true statement. First day I worked for Mick, I put in an honest 14-hour day.
And how many years did you stay with him in that position?
Less than one, actually, just a few months. And I had been exposed to real estate, and I realized that Mick was a real estate guy, and I did more talking and asking questions than I probably did work. And he would actually tell me, you're not allowed to talk until, and he would say like 10 o'clock or something. And I kept looking at my watch thinking it's almost question time. So I had questions about everything. The first job I worked for him on, he was building a fourplex, and I asked all about the numbers. And he said he paid $5,000 for the lot, $25,000 for all of the materials. He did 100% of the labor with the exception of maybe 10% of it. His all-in cost was $30,000. I asked how much they rented for, and I believe it was $350 a unit. And I was doing the math thinking, I can live in one of these units free, use two of the rents to pay all of the expenses, and actually get paid to live here. So my first plan, my first real estate plan, was to actually build a fourplex. I was on a mission to get $30,000 together so that I could build a fourplex, never have to work again, and live happily ever after.
Okay. I just enjoy some of these early goals, if you will, because you've kind of dwarfed them, but that was like, it's like getting your goal list and you have your retread tires that you want to get.
Yes. And the one that still humors me, Bruce, is I read Joe Carbo's Lazy Man's Way to Riches, and you had to put your goals on a 3x5 card. And I figured if I'm going to be a businessman, all businessmen wear suits. And I have a card still to this day, one of the original ones that says, I, Mike Cantu, am the proud owner of not one, but two business suits. Figured I was going big and I could rotate them. And I never did get that suit, Bruce. Never got it.
But you did get those tires out of Hawk.
I did. I put the 20 down on the four retreads of J&J tire, had a $40 balance, went in and paid a second 20. And I remember picking them up. I gave the guy a 10, a 5, 5 ones, and they put the tires on and away I went. 2 days later, I was driving down the freeway and I heard the flap, 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 flap noise. And part of my tire was coming off, but McDonald's was having a promotion to where if you bought a steak sandwich that they had at the time, you got a steak knife. Now, I can't imagine giving away knives to McDonald's now, but they did back then. And I had one in my glove box. I pulled it over on the freeway, carved off a big piece of rubber that was flapping, and jumped back in my car, and away I went. But it all worked out.
That's pretty cool. When did you start? You started being a partner with Mick. So he was still building. So I know you guys got involved in developing land, and mostly did you buy, you built new homes at that point?
No, originally when I was working for Mick, we had a falling out, and I shared that at your, or I Survived Real Estate a few years ago. It was kind of a long story, but we did have a falling out, and I ran back into him at Conley's Hardware Store. In the meantime, since our falling out, I had gone to a real estate seminar. I met a guy there that we became partners, and we ended up buying three properties. So when I ran into Mick at the hardware store, he asked what I'd been up to. I proudly puffed up my chest and said, I've been real estate, just like you. And we had a brief conversation. Now, we had not, when I said we had a falling out, when I saw Mick, he was on a different aisle than I was. And we were talking over the display, and Mick had cleared it out so we could communicate. And he says, let me come around the other side and we'll talk. Well, I knew he wanted a piece of me in the worst way. So as he came to my side, I went the opposite way and we just traded sides. And I said, come on, Blackwell, I know you want a piece of me. And he says, you're darn right I do. So it could have been interesting in Connolly's in the WD-40 aisle. But at that point, we talked for about a half an hour in different aisles, and he laid the groundwork. He says, well, you know, I've got some money. If you've got a good deal, give me a call. I called them the next day. We went to a courthouse steps foreclosure sale where the high bidders, opening bid was 13. We paid 16 and some change. And we now had a fixer upper in San Bernardino. We were off and running.
And over the course of the next 3 decades, how many such transactions would you say occurred?
Mick and I did several hundred deals together, and it got to the point where Mick was slowing down. He had his apartments and probably 60, 70 houses. He started slowing down. I was speeding up, so we never parted company, but I became independent of him. But throughout my buying career, Mick was always first in line for wholesale deals. And for many years, the number was 18 to 24 deals a year he wanted from me. Mick would typically, his goal was to keep one house a month and to flip one house a month to fund the house that he kept.
Okay.
So I had a built-in buyer and didn't always get top dollar out of them. In fact, I never got top dollar out of them. I always had to leave a lot of meat on the bone, but it worked out good for both of us.
What was the year approximately when you were starting, when you had, like, say, that conversation at the Conleith?
That was 1983.
Okay. 83. Wow.
1983. I went to real estate seminar April 17th and 18th of 1982. That was the Robert Allen No Money Down seminar that I went to with my roommate. We sat in a class for 2 days, learned 101 ways to buy real estate. And I remember on Sunday evening on the way home, I asked Chuck, I said, "Hey, any idea what that mortgage thing they talked about all weekend was?" And he says, "No, I was hoping you knew." So we learned 101 ways to buy real estate, but I did not understand the mortgage concept.
Okay. By the time 89, 90 came around, you and Mick had some land developments, correct?
Yes, we had gone to the high desert, and it started off buying a couple of 2.5 acre lots, building spec homes. They sold. I was very interested what the other entrepreneurs were doing up there. And the typical was but to buy 5 or 10 acres, split it into 2.5 acre lots, and either build on the lots or sell the lots. The sum of the parts was greater than the whole was the theory there. And that led to a big subdivision. It was 140 acres. I think we did 54 2.5 acre lots. That was a big learning experience. I was doing some other developing at the time. I thought that was my future. By the time I got to the end of that project, I never wanted to develop anything ever again.
The cycle changed. When did you realize that it wasn't going to work, as far as the cycle wasn't going to allow it to work?
That was about the time Saddam Hussein was ready to blow up the world and the economy just grinded to a stop. And that was the one factor I hadn't put in there. It was my first experience going into a down market. I had no idea about cycles in real estate. That I knew it was a long, windy road to get to the finish line, and I was within sight of the finish line, but it felt like my car ran out of gas to where I could see it, but there was going to be a tough road to get there.
You and Mick had an interesting conversation, because lots are pretty much the worst inventory you can get stuck with in a downturn, and you had quite a few of them, and you also had financing on them, as I recall.
And we did, and it was all private financing. It was a very large amount, and I was concerned over it.
And Mick, you and I have had the privilege of lots of lunches, so that I know some stories. But I think it's important for people to realize the character behind the success. So you had all this private debt, and you guys didn't go anywhere.
No, I had no idea how we were going to get out of it. And I had mentioned the word bankruptcy to Mick, and his face just wadded up like a piece of tinfoil. And he leaned into me and said that we signed a note, and it starts off with the promise to pay. And these people sacrificed to set money aside for a better tomorrow and entrusted it to us, and we're not going to disappoint them. And he said it very matter-of-factly to where I thought, well, that option's off the table. So we worked it out. Everybody was made whole. And that was an 18-month period that shaped the way I did business for the rest of however long I'm in business for.
Yeah, probably the best thing you ever tackled, because you gave yourself no other option but to solve it.
Right, right. And Mick, they're anything short of making everybody whole was not an option.
Yeah, that's very cool. And you don't sell land usually in that market, so you got creative.
Oh, yes. I ran a perpetual ad in the LA Times that said, custom home sites for sale or will trade for anything of value. And nobody bought any of those lots, but I did trade off a whole bunch of them, got a lot of interesting things, got quite a few vehicles, got a big Winnebago with the slipping transmission. I got a Cessna airplane with a blown motor. Now, I sold the airplane before I bought it. It was at the Apple Valley Airport, and the mechanic there agreed to buy it. My whole plan was to take an unsaleable item, convert it to anything that was saleable, then liquidate that for cash.
And that's where the phrase, take what you have to get what you need to get what you want.
Exactly. Use what you have to get what you need to get what you want. What I had was dirt that was unsaleable. What I needed was something I could liquidate. What I wanted was cash.
After that, we entered into the REO phase, completely different world, because we didn't have that phase, it didn't seem like, between 83 and 89. So how did you adjust what you did as a buyer?
I went after the REOs. I hooked up with an agent and worked with John for many years. I was his only client. I did all of the homework. I would, that was back when they had the multiple listing book. He got the book, but I would go through it, cut out everything I was interested in, put it on a page, go look at it, do the numbers. And John's entire existence was filling out offer forms. And I ended up during that stretch, bought about a little over 300 houses with John as my agent, kept a few of them. Retailed a bunch of them and wholesaled some of them.
Okay. When did you start keeping a fair amount of rentals? Was that always part of your plan?
Mick forced me into it early on. And looking back, Mick had lots of income from his apartments, from his spec home building, and he was still a plumber that did copper repipes Monday through Friday, up until about 6 till noon. So Mick had plenty of money. I would bring these deals to the table. Mick would talk me into keeping it, and then I'd run out of money. And Mick bought a lot of my half ownerships. And he always said the same thing. Every time I'd sell him half a house, he'd say, you know, Mike, I will write you a very small check for a very large piece of your future. And it would hurt when he would say it that way, but I thought, okay, but this gets me gas, food, keeps the lights on, and got to do what I got to do. But we kept stuff early on, and first year I was in business, I had rentals, and I've been a landlord ever since then. Next year, spring of next year, is 40 years as a full-time real estate entrepreneur.
That's a long time, 4 decades. Seen a lot of a lot of ups and downs in that 40 years too.
Yes. And Bruce, I spent the morning going over some deals, made a deal, working on a very interesting deal. So I still love the game. I love playing the game.
You and I talked about, it just seemed like a week or two ago, and we were just chatting and I started taking notes off of what you were saying. That's how good some of it was. And I never do that.
Wow. I'm honored, Bruce.
I never do that. Well, you said one thing was really interesting about, you know, obviously you don't need to make a living that way, but you still love the game. But you said something that you still are enjoy the climb. Is that how you said it?
I'm most comfortable in the climb. That, yes, I long ago got to a point where I could do anything I wanted. See, Bruce, that's always been my entire goal in life. I've set lots of goals, but as I drill down deeper, they all come back to the same thing. And that's basically waking up and being able to do whatever I want to do. And I love the deal-making part of it. And I've been planning my retirement since fourth grade. And when I got to the point to where I could retire, I thought, well, now what do you do? It's going to be no different than what I'm doing now because I thoroughly enjoy what I do.
Yeah, that's a pretty amazing statement. Do you have a preferable cycle to buy in? Do you prefer the REO agent and the lender-owned properties or the talking to the people that own stuff?
I much, much prefer a one-on-one, Bruce. I like solving problems, and I am constantly going after the root of the problem and what it's going to take to solve the problem. I said I was working on an interesting deal right now, and it involves a life estate that everything revolves around brother staying in this house for the rest of his life. And yeah, I was doing homework on it this morning. I've done several drafts of, and it's all, it's uncharted territory for me. I've been educated on life estates, but I don't know the details. So I found that absolutely fascinating this morning. And then all of a sudden, 2 hours later, I'm still reading. And I thought, what happened? So I do get passionate about stuff and I love solving problems. So I much prefer a one-on-one with the seller.
Okay. Well, there are markets like this one where that's basically all there is. But okay, well, let's start from the beginning. How are you sourcing the seller, the potential seller?
What do you mean? How am I sourcing?
How are you getting them to contact you?
Oh, okay. Okay. Well, Bruce, I'm still a direct mailer and I've always been a house buyer, not a home buyer. So I don't like dealing with owner occupants. Early on, I used to door knock and bought foreclosures, stuff like that, but it always bothered me. There's a big difference between a house and a home. And I prefer the unemotional house side of things to where it's not the residence, it's not the roof over the head, it's always kind of pulling on my heartstrings when somebody gets in trouble. And it really bothered me when I'd be sitting at someone's kitchen table and I'd come up with four or five solutions and me as the buyer was never the number one solution. And if I didn't share that with somebody, it just weighed heavy on me to where I felt like I was lying by omission.
Okay.
And then I overcame that by throwing everything out on the table and they'd always run off and take choice number one or two that solved their problem and left me nothing, but I felt better about it. But I realized this is going nowhere. That's not my calling, being the do-gooder in life and solving everyone's problem and starving. So I moved out of that arena and I much prefer buying a vacant house, a rental house, not owner occupied.
How has the mailer changed over time? Do you play with changes or have you got one that you go, this is good?
Absolutely, Bruce. And I get more mail now than I ever have. A day doesn't go by. I've had two text messages today. I had a cold call this morning. I had at least two cold calls yesterday to where I've never done anything except direct mail and then follow up with phone call. And I'm not a stranger when I call them because I've already mailed to them.
Right. And you're the one that's making the phone call. There's no intermediary person.
Oh, no. See, I get the virtual assistants with strong accents that are hard to understand. And I had one the other day to where I said, I'm a seller. And then she said, the next thing she says is how many bedrooms? And I said, property profile will disclose all of that. How many bathrooms? And she just kept going down a script. And I said, look, I'm a live seller and you're about to get hung up on. You want to take down? And she kept going right through the script. And I told her, have a nice day. And that was the end of that.
Wow. And you were just trying to see what they did with the lead?
Yes. And I do have a house that I keep throwing out to people. And I've yet to get an offer on it, Bruce. I've thrown the address out at least half a dozen times to cold callers, and there's plenty of equity in the house, and I've yet to get an offer.
That's interesting.
And I think they've got systems set up. They've got the people calling, people texting, but I never got a price.
No one ever asks you what you want for it.
Well, they always ask me that, and I say, you're the buyer. Give me your best shot. What do you want to know?
Okay.
You called me. And I'm always curious, Bruce. As a buyer, I like to see how other people operate. I've got a string of text messages from one outfit. They're trying to buy something from me in Huntington Beach, which they would have to pry my cold, dead fingers off of to get it away from me. But I think we're up to 37 different texts. And somewhere a dozen texts ago, they said, would you like an offer? Yes. And still nothing yet. They just keep sending texts.
Okay. The odds of, if you could give me numbers, let's say out of 1,000 mailers, what would be the number of phone calls you'll probably get?
Now, that all depends, Bruce. The nicer the area, the less phone calls. The worse the area, the more phone calls, the more targeted your list. I like a target-specific list. Everything falls into one of two categories, owner-occupied or non-owner-occupied, but you can break down the non-owner occupied way down into several niche categories, tailor a message towards that and take it from there.
Okay. So after you do that, let's say you've done your targeting. If you send 1,000 mailers, what percentage responds?
Any more, I'm going to say 0 to 8.
Okay. I guess, you know, I want people to realize that it's going to be something that you have to realize is going to be an expensive journey until you get a deal. And then obviously it pays for it for many months.
Well, that's going to do it for this week's episode of the Norris Group Real Estate Radio Show and Podcast. Be sure to tune in next week for part two of our interview with real estate investor Mike Cantu. See you then.
See isurvivedrealestate.com for event details, information on all our generous sponsors, and to connect with our speakers.
For more information on hard money loans and upcoming events with the Norris Group, check out thenorrisgroup.com. For information on passive investing with trust deeds, visit tngtrustdeeds.com.
The Norris Group originates and services loans in California and Florida under California DRE License 01219911, Florida Mortgage Lender License 1577, and NMLS License 1623669. For more information on hard money lending, go to thenorrisgroup.com and click the Hard Money tab.